The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. For the first time in over a decade, deaths from a toxic, unregulated drug supply and overdose are reportedly beginning to decline in much of the U.S. Leaving aside the questions of how many such deaths are going uninvestigated and unreported due to budget shortfalls and a lack of staff and other resources for medical examiner offices around the nation, the toxic, unregulated drug supply and overdose remain the leading cause of death for adults in the U.S. under the age of 50, and Black, Latine, and Indigenous communities continue to be disproportionately affected. On Saturday, May 31st, the Big Cities Health Coalition and Vital Strategies convened a panel of public health and harm reduction experts to present new national polling data and to spotlight the latest stories from the front lines of community building and harm reduction, including the unveiling of the new buyla4la.org website. I had the honor of attending that event and recording the audio, so today and next week we're going to hear from some of the panelists. But first, I had the good fortune recently to attend Health Journalism 2025, the annual conference of the Association of Healthcare Journalists. While there, I ran into a good friend, the journalist and best-selling author Maya Salovitz, whose books include Undoing Drugs and The Unbroken Brain. Here's part of our conversation.
There's two words that we need to really eradicate in the addiction. Well, there's more, but I'll speak about two for now. Abuse is what somebody does to a child or to a spouse or to, you know, when we talk about abuse, we hear child abuse, emotional abuse, domestic abuse, sexual abuse. You don't abuse a poor little drug. The drug is not being victimized. No one is being victimized if you misuse a substance other than yourself, simply by the characteristic of you misusing the substance or you using the substance. That doesn't necessarily, in fact, the vast majority of substance use is not misuse and is not harm. So when you say substance abuse, people, and there's been studies on this, people automatically assume that the person who is doing the abuse is an abuser. And when you hear the term abuser, you think like rapist, somebody who is a pedophile, like you think of all these horrible associations. The vast majority of people who use drugs are none of those things and are not harming anybody other than themselves or even themselves in the case of most use in general. So it is really ridiculous. I think what people have tried to do historically with the idea of substance abuse, the DSM originally included the term because it was supposed to be a milder form of the condition. So the idea was that somebody who has substance abuse is a college binge drinker, essentially. And they're engaging in quite risky behavior that could kill them. But, you know, 99% of them are going to stop without any treatment. So that was supposed to be the milder form. And then they had a diagnosis that they called dependence, which is the other word we need to stamp out of the addictions field. Dependence, you know, dependence is just needing somebody to function or someone or some substance to function without experiencing bad things happening to you. So if I have heart disease and I need certain medications for that, I'm dependent on those medications. If I don't take them, I might die. If I have depression and Prozac works for me and I stop taking it, I will probably get depressed again. So I'm dependent on those things. But nobody is robbing drugstores for blood pressure medications. And nobody is sitting around like writing odes to their blood pressure medication or even to their Prozac, because we don't, the way that medication works is either it works and you feel better, or it doesn't, and you think it's a horrible drug. But when you are addicted to something, I'll just put it this way. I never forgot to take my heroin. I have sometimes forgotten to take my Prozac. And if you can forget to take a medication, you are not addicted to it, even though your life might depend on you continuing to take it. Like, you can forget your blood pressure medications and all of these, like, you know, because you're not craving them. You're not using them despite negative consequences. And that's what addiction is. So when we confuse addiction and dependence, the problem is that cocaine becomes non-addictive because nobody, you know, pukes or shakes or needs to go to the hospital because they don't have cocaine. They may be very badly craving it and feel terrible, but that is not physical dependence, right? If dependence and addiction are the same, then Prozac is addictive and cocaine isn't, which is a ridiculous outcome. And also, people who are taking medication for opioid use disorder, like methadone or buprenorphine, are still addicted, substituting one addiction for another. They're not in recovery. They haven't got better, even if everything else about their life, they have their kids back, they have their job back, they have their family back, they're like working, they're doing all of the things we want people to do, and they're doing them well. This is not the same as being actively addicted to heroin or fentanyl. So the other thing that dependence does that's problematic is that it makes you think about people that needing someone is bad. All humans are interdependent. We all need each other. Like, if we don't get our heads around this, we're going to end up with massive amounts of problems. Dependence itself should not be pathologized. Dependence is only a problem when it's accompanied by compulsive use despite negative consequences, or in the case of a substance that is not addictive, you could be dependent on a substance that's bad for you in some ways, like a medication that has outlived its usefulness. But again, that's not addiction. And unless we distinguish between the two, you're going to leave people who are in pain and need opioid medications to treat their pain, they're automatically seen as addicted. And it's just really dumb. So we got to get rid of both abuse and dependence. And I will add, we should also get rid of codependence and enabling. Because A, codependence, we're all interdependent. And yes, people do have difficult relationships with people with addictions, but they're no more specific to having a bad relationship with a person with addiction than having a bad relationship with a person with depression or having a bad relation with a person with no diagnosis. It's dysfunctional relationships are a problem, and sometimes they occur around substances. If you are, so enabling needs to go because, okay, we know from harm reduction research that if you provide people clean needles, you provide even heroin or other forms of safer supply, you provide a safe place to inject or smoke the drugs, that people who are in those settings or participating have more likelihood of seeking more traditional forms of treatment and more traditional forms of recovery, not less. So if enabling were true, then if I gave you free heroin, it would make your addiction last longer. Since giving free heroin, as we know from studies from Switzerland and Germany and a couple of other places, since that does not happen, the whole concept needs to be thrown out the window. We can talk about the enablers of President Trump, but it's not because he's an addict, although maybe you could argue he's, well, I'll just say this. They are enabling a sociopath, and one should not do that. But that does not mean anything about addiction, nor does it have anything to do with whether they are codependent or any of these things. It's just, we need to get rid of that language because the concepts are so harmful or just so vaguely defined that they become useless.
Okay, so you're going to be speaking to journalists about how to cover substance use and all this kind of stuff. What are you hoping people take away from your talk?
What I'd like people to know is just that a lot of what they've been taught about addiction treatment, addiction care, the nature of addiction, what drugs do, all of the stuff in this area has been filled with many decades of misinformation. And we've been told over and over again a lot of things that are simply not true, that are now accepted as conventional wisdom, such as the existence of codependence or the idea of enabling or the idea that substance abuse is a thing that we should talk about. You know, that idea got taken out of the DSM like in 2013. It's like more than 10 years ago, and it is ridiculous. So I want people to understand that they need to ask the right questions and they need to look at why they're being told the things that they're being told. When people say, oh, you know, if you provide a safe space for people to use drugs, that's enabling them and they'll never get into recovery. Well, if you look at the research, actually people who use these places are, I think it's 4 to 5 times more likely to get into recovery than people who don't. So it's, you know, the common sense you've been taught about how to help people with addiction is based on a complete misconception of what addiction is. And we now know, like, I've been fighting over the definition of addiction for like 30 years. And the best thing we've been able to come up with, and this is used by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, which would change its name, but it needs an act of Congress, and the DSM, which doesn't need to change its name. But, you know, the definition is compulsive drug use or other behaviors that continue in the face of negative consequences. And what that means is that it doesn't respond to punishment. Negative consequences is often a nicer way of saying punishment. So by definition, addiction does not respond to all of the things that we think, like tough love or hitting bottom or stopping enabling or any of these things. You know, it may be the case that if you have an addicted loved one and they are doing things that are harmful to your family, you might have to distance yourself from them. And that you should do because you need to take care of yourself and the rest of your family if that's what's going on. You just can't do it thinking that it's going to help that other person. Like, harming people generally does not help them. Occasionally when someone gets hurt, they turn their life around and do wonderful things. But that doesn't mean we, you know, suggest that, for example, like, I'm sure, oh my God, I'm spacing the name of this author, but he wrote about finding meaning and purpose when he was in a concentration camp. And should we... you know, start having concentration camps. We're already going to do it. Hopefully not. But no, those are not opportunities for emotional growth. Those are opportunities for oppression and evil. And yes, if somebody manages to make some meaning out of that, that's fabulous. But that doesn't mean that we should harm people to help them.
That was from my conversation with journalist and best-selling author Maya Salovitz. We spoke recently at the Association of Healthcare Journalists Conference, Health Journalism 2025. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now to our main story. As I mentioned at the top of the show, on Saturday, May 31st, the Big Cities Health Coalition and Vital Strategies convened a panel of public health and harm reduction experts to present new national polling data and to spotlight the latest stories from the front lines of community building and harm reduction, including the official unveiling of the buyla4la.org website. Let's hear opening remarks by Chrissy Giuliano, Executive Director of the Big Cities Health Coalition.
So, you know, there's some good news. We're finally seeing some progress in decreasing overdose deaths nationally. And again, this is national data. After years of dramatic increases in both fatal and non-fatal overdoses, we're seeing signs that what we're doing is working. We need to build on these relative successes, and this is not the time for anyone to take their foot off the gas. We really need to continue the hard work. So CDC recently reported that in 2024, overdose deaths nationally dropped 27% compared to the year before. Now, a couple of things to note as you look again at this high-level national data. The national trend hasn't been seen everywhere. It's not the same in every state and community across the country. There are always new challenges popping up, new drugs that enter the market, things like that. And overdose deaths are still too high. It's also really important to note that gains have not been seen equally across all populations. So systemic inequalities like racism have meant that Black and Native Americans in particular have their substance use issues treated differently, all too often with incarceration rather than harm reduction or treatment options or recovery options. And you see that in the data when you look down into it. So this is the map of our membership. But also, it is the footprint of research that we did earlier this year. So our members are in these 35 cities, and they're really doing, if I can brag for just a moment, some of the most innovative and effective work to save lives and prevent overdose. So we did some research in our footprint, and I'm going to say that like five times. Our research is not nationally representative. It is specific to 35 big cities, which you can assume does not mimic sort of national political ideology, things like that. But it is representative across our membership in terms of gender and age and things like that. So what we were looking for in this research was to better understand what city residents think is important about harm reduction, how they think about it, and how we can better explain and how our members can better explain how important this set of tools is in protecting the public's health. So before we get into the data, just to level set, harm reduction strategies focus on keeping those who use drugs not just alive, but as healthy as possible. They focus on preventing overdose and death, in part by keeping lines of communication open between those who use drugs and health providers, and making and recognizing that not everyone is yet ready to seek treatment, but thinking through a continuum of where folks are and meeting them where they are. We know from previous polling that we did about a year ago that city residents, again in our footprint, broadly support a public health approach to the overdose crisis. And so what we did this year was really focus in, again, on this harm reduction piece to think about what might persuade folks to change their minds. And I'll just, before I talk about this, I'll say at a high level, there's a really good segment of the population that understand this and get these concepts and want to support it. And so we really see the work that we do and what our members do is finding those people and helping them tell the story and support these things locally. So on the slide, you can see that we asked city residents to rank the benefits of harm reduction. And there's this whole list. The top three, really important. They said that saving lives, treating drug users like human beings, and providing a bridge to recovery were the most important benefits or the top benefits of a harm reduction approach. And we're gonna, these slides I think are in the program, but if not, we can share them and then, I'll give you that pitch that later about. This is nationally. So this is all in our 35 member jurisdictions. Okay, so we also then gave respondents a list of harm reduction strategies, and we asked them, you know, sort of, what's your comfort level? What do you think of this? All of the harm reduction strategies had majority support, and the strongest support is what's on this slide. So naloxone, medications to help stop drug use, and fentanyl test strips. You know, these are fairly well-known tools, and they're well used in communities across the country. But they're also ones that are most focused on saving lives and again, sort of helping bridge people to recovery. You know, that's where we think it sort of popped with participants. The other thing to note is there was broad support for many of these. It's somewhat weak support. People aren't sure, right? With the exception of naloxone, where more than half said they're very comfortable with it. When you look at the very versus somewhat, there's some room there, again, to tell this story, to talk about why it's important and make sure that, you know, people understand why this is a critical public health tool. So another key finding, which, again, sometimes when you do polls, you're happy that the findings support what you think. Personal stories of harm reduction really did change people's minds. So we shared videos that Vital Strategies, who is a key partner and funder in this work, that Vital Strategies produced. Half of the survey respondents saw the videos, half did not. Those who saw the videos showed a marked increase in supporting harm reduction strategies at the end. So we did sort of a pre and a post. Anyone who moved saw the video. So it really does illustrate, you know, the importance of telling the story, humanizing folks, and just giving texture to what this is in people's lives. So I've shared like really high level info with you guys today. We didn't want to take too much time. But I do encourage you, here's the pitch. No, I encourage you to sign up for newsletter, which with a little QR. We will be producing more information from this data. I think this is only the second time we've shared it, you know, outside of our team. There's lots in there. There'll be more things that we can share. And if you have specific questions, we're happy to answer those. You know, it's just really important to continue to pay attention to the trajectory of overdose policy and practice right now. We're making great strides, but we're also likely about to see a massive disinvestment in federal resources for this work, both dollars and expertise. We are losing both at the federal level. So at the same time, we're also seeing a potential influx of dollars from opioid settlements, right? So it's complicated, it's hard, it's messy, and we really do want to keep telling this story with and for you.
That was Chrissy Giuliano, Executive Director of the Big Cities Health Coalition, speaking on a panel May 31st entitled Progress in a Crisis, Stories and Data on Harm Reduction from the Front Lines of Overdose Response. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Another speaker on that panel was Dr. Brian Hurley with the L.A. County Department of Public Health.
So I'm Brian. I'm an addiction psychiatrist. I work for the LA County Department of Public Health. And we have an initiative called Reaching the 95% of People Impacted by Substance Use. What does that mean? Well, if you look at all the people with substance use disorder in the United States, and then ask how many of those people get treatment for their substance use disorder, you end up with 15% of people receive any form of treatment, any medications, any counseling, any support, in any setting of care. And then if you say, okay, how many of those people went to a specialty substance use treatment program, aka detox, rehab, high intensity outpatient programs, I can get increasingly technical with respect to the ASAM criteria, but most people know what I'm talking about, a specialty addiction treatment program. It's 6%. So if as a public health strategy, we say, well, there's a lot of people at risk of overdose, people should be in treatment, we have sorely underpenetrated the population that we need in order to be able to show health outcomes. So on this basis, we say, how do we reach this 95% of people who aren't interested in the way that substance use treatment is delivered? And you say, Brian, why are you telling me that they're not interested? Well, if you ask the 85 to 95% of people that aren't in treatment, while they're not in treatment, they will tell you it's because they didn't want it. Now, I'm an addiction psychiatrist, work for the health department. And this pushed me and us in the department to ask, why are we selling something nobody wants? Right? Why are we selling something that nobody wants? Well, you know, I work with patients. And if you ask somebody, are you ready to commit to full sustained abstinence from alcohol, tobacco, and all other intoxicants forevermore? The answer is typically not sure. The answer is typically, well, some variant of no or maybe, right? But if you ask the question differently, you say, are you interested in any medications or counseling support to help advance your health and wellness? You don't have to stop using substances, right? This can just help you use less, use safer, right? It can give you some skills and strategies of being able to advance your health and wellness. You get different responses, right? People say, sure, maybe I'll do parts of this, not that. The working with people impacted by substance use includes a whole range of public health strategies. And my colleagues, Shoshana and Veronica, who you're going to hear from, and I have had the opportunity of traveling the globe and learning around what do other health jurisdictions do. So we pulled this slide from Barcelona. Thank you to the Health Department of Barcelona for lending us a slide. But if we really talk about what do we do to impact people impacted by substance use, we actually start with youth development and health promotion. How do you avoid adverse childhood experiences? How do you help protect, advance the wellness of the community so that there isn't concentrated poverty, the social determinants of health don't impact some communities differentially from others, right? It is really a how do you help people develop so that they don't rely on substances as a way of self-regulating their emotional states, right? So that's where actually substance use prevention really starts, is less having anything to do with drugs and more communities working together. And there's also a role for substance use prevention, psychoeducation and information around the risks of substances and how they work. And, you know, that's what we typically think in substance use prevention programs. But you'll notice a box, and there's a box around harm reduction and substance use treatment and recovery, because the reality is recovery is a learning experience for most people. People go into and out of substance use all of the time. And we have to have a range of services that support people when they're ready to not use and when they're ready to use, right? Like they're both part of a health strategy. And a health department should probably also monitor and surveil and keep track of epidemiology and look at trends that help impact these interventions. So this continuum of substance use interventions, particularly that link harm reduction with treatment, is such an important part of reaching this 95%. Many of you may be familiar with the Prochaska-DiClemente stages of change model. This is a loosely empirically based model, but what I like about this is that it says we have to align services with readiness. If you have somebody who says, I am not ready to stop using methamphetamine, I might be ready to stop injecting, right? I can think about smoking or using in different ways. If you then try to put that person in a residential treatment program, watch how quickly they leave. That's not a service that's aligned with that person's level of readiness. And if you have somebody who says, this is it, I am, to borrow a phrase, sick and tired of being sick and tired, and I'm ready to commit to full sustained abstinence from alcohol, tobacco, and all other toxins moving forward, you don't want to miss the opportunity to connect people to resources that advance that. It's about aligning services with readiness. And the error that I see in popular discourse is we pit these things against each other. Do you believe in harm reduction or treatment? I'm like, I believe in both, aligned with helping advance somebody where they are in their personal recovery. So the Reaching the 95% initiative was our health department strategy working with the Substance Use Treatment Network to make it easier for people to enter treatment, even if they weren't interested in stopping to use, and increase, you know, because if we're waiting for people to come to treatment, and right now 95% of people don't, that's not going to be sufficient. Even if we doubled our treatment capacity and really solved all of the access issues that still exist, we wouldn't be reaching enough people. We have to bring treatment to people. Field-based services, where we engage people where they are in their lives.
That was Dr. Brian Hurley with the LA County Department of Public Health speaking on a panel entitled Progress in a Crisis, Stories and Data on Harm Reduction from the Front Lines of Overdose Response, at which new national polling data on harm reduction and drug policies were presented and the new official website, byla4la.org, was unveiled. We'll hear more from that panel next week. For now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's Audio Port service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Find this edition of Century, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.